Ramesh.
Hi, Bob.
How are you?
Just great. Yourself?
I am. I'm okay. I'm not complaining. You are Ramesh Panuru of the National Review, and I am Bob Wright. You're in the Washington area, where things are pretty dramatic at the moment. The president has unveiled his new healthcare plan. And I guess the day after this airs, we're taping this Tuesday afternoon, it'll air Wednesday, then on Thursday they're going to have this encounter, right? He's going to have this encounter with Democrats and, more notably, Republicans and talk about health care, right?
Yes. I think they're calling it a summit, not an encounter.
A summit.
Which sounds a little...
Not an encounter. That would be a little too fuzzy and new agey. What's your take here? The political wisdom of this.
Well, the smartest thing politically the administration, the Democrats, have done recently is to put this price controls for health insurance proposal on the table. I suspect it'll be very popular. I'm not sure how really the Republicans respond to it. Although Republicans are almost all going to think that it's terrible policy.
I
certainly agree with that. But otherwise, I mean, leaving aside that move, I'm not sure what else is really going to help the Democrats here. I mean, I understand they want – well, my assumption is that President Obama believes – that contrasting his proposals to the Republicans' proposals, and particularly to the Paul Ryan type proposals, will make his look better in comparison. At least that's what I think the strategy is. It's a little hard to tell because sometimes over the last week they seem to have reverted to the Republicans have no ideas approach as opposed to the Republicans have bad ideas. Mm-hmm. It would seem to me that the wise thing for them to do there would be to say they have no workable ideas and go from there. But at the end of the day, I just don't see how they persuade House Democrats who voted against the bill last time around to vote for it this time. And that, it seems to me, is the crucial step. I keep reading these analyses of why this is in the Democrats' best interest to get this passed, having spent so long on it, but I don't see why it's in the interest of an individual House Democrat who hasn't voted for this to vote for it, and they've got to flip a few people in order to make this get enacted.
Right. The idea being that the margin by which it passed has, for various reasons, evaporated, right?
Yeah, it was a tiny margin. It was a 220 to 215 vote. Bart Stupak has said that the current, who voted for it last time, was part of that 220, has said the current abortion language in the bills is unacceptable to him as a pro-life Democrat. Mm-hmm. Joe Gow, the one Republican, is also defecting. Wexler, a Democrat who supported the bill, has left Congress. Of course, John Murtha, who voted for the bill, has passed away. And Neil Abercrombie is supposed to be out of the House about a week and a half. Mm-hmm. So, and if you assume that maybe some people who voted for it last time are looking at what I think are much worse numbers for the Democrats and a much worse atmosphere since the fall, might want to vote the other way. So you put those in to the equation as well, and Pelosi needs to flip a bunch of votes.
So you're assuming, first of all, that they will use this reconciliation technique so that the filibuster in the Senate won't be the big problem. But you're thinking they'll still need, what, 5-10 House votes, maybe even more?
Well, one of the questions...
I would think at that level you can cut backdoor deals unrelated to the legislation, right? I mean, give them assurances of various kinds on particular issues...
Right, yeah, and if there were particular issues that were standing in the way of Democrats voting for the bill, that might work. If, on the other hand, it is, I don't want to touch this thing with a 10-foot pole because it's unpopular and the Republicans in my district are engaged and furious and mobilized enough, then that's mm-hmm. that's not going to work. You know, one of the things you you encounter when you make this sort of argument, I was making this argument, actually, by the way, before Scott Brown took off in the run-up to the Massachusetts special election. I thought that people were underestimating how hard it was going to be for Pelosi to get 218 votes in the House. And the thing you'd keep hearing, and you still hear a little bit, is, well, Pelosi probably had some votes in her back pocket. You know, if she'd needed to, she would have gotten them to vote for the bill, and maybe this next time she will need them.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me there are two problems with that. Number one, my best guess on this is that Pelosi would not have agreed to the pro-life Stupak amendment if she hadn't had to. If she'd had a bunch of votes to spare, she wouldn't have voted for, she wouldn't have allowed that to be voted on and pass and become part of the House bill, which means that there's probably at most she had about 10 or 11 votes to spare, probably less than that. And the second thing is, even folks who said back then, look, if you really need me, I'll be with you, but I'd rather not vote for this, obviously even then they didn't want to vote for it. They didn't think it was in their political interest. By now, they may have reached the conclusion that they're not going to make themselves available.
Mm-hmm. But what about the argument? I mean, first of all, there's this argument that has been made by, I think, both John Chait and Jonathan Cohn at the New Republic, where, and this is before this last series of maneuvers, but the idea was, look, you might as well pass the bill you've already voted for. This applies to those who have already voted for it, at least, because you're already on the downside. Even if it doesn't pass, they can still make the campaign commercial, your opponent can, depicting you as having voted for whatever you voted for. You might as well at least pass the thing and then show people that, you know, hey, it passed, and look, no death panels materialized. You know, in other words, get them to think in more concrete terms about what the thing actually involves, and most people will see there's nothing obviously horrible about it from their point of view. Now, I guess, strictly speaking, that only applies to people who've already voted for the bill, but you know, isn't there kind of this yeah. argument of broader application that, look, once the bill is, that the polls reflect how successful the scare stories have been, but once the bill passes, there aren't all that many people who will see their interests as damaged, and a lot of people will realize that they'll be helped?
Yeah, well, okay, well, three things. First, as you said, this only applies to people who've already voted for it. Second, I think it would actually be easier for somebody to flip in the direction of public opinion than flip against it. That is, I don't actually think that it would be so terrible for some congressman to say, look, I voted for this, I wanted to keep the process going and hope that the bill would get improved, but since then it's become clear to me this is not an acceptable bill, and the tide in my district, you know, I'm listening to my voters and they don't want me to do this. I think that would be a plausible line of defense for a congressman. And then the last point, and maybe the most important one, is I do think that in general this bill is structured so that some of the costs come early and the benefits don't come for several years. Now, there are a few things that they've designed to come up early, but basically to get the budget numbers to come out right, they have delayed a lot of these benefits for a fairly long time. And that, I think, means that there are plenty of opportunities for opponents to keep campaigning against it even after the thing's gotten enacted, assuming it does.
Well, of course, they're also now delaying the costs more than
they
were.
Some of them, yes.
But that's one thing Obama has done, is pushed off that tax on Cadillac plans so that it sinks in later and at a high, and that the threshold for it is a little higher. You know, I've always wondered, and David Brooks wrote a column today saying this just means that these costs will never kick in. It'll never pay for itself. Congress will, you know, legislate the costs out of existence before they have time to kick in. I don't know if that's true. But, you know, what I wonder is, why don't they ever pass these things in a kind of boil the frog slowly manner, you know, like a quarter of the tax kicks in 3 years, a quarter down the road, a quarter even further, and then it just almost wouldn't be worth it for Congress to intervene at any given point.
Yeah, you know, I was not convinced by that exact argument of Brooks's that you
mentioned.
By David,
yeah, okay. Good.
I'm sorry.
I'm just glad to hear that that's not a valid argument, because you know more about it than I do.
Well, it just seems to me, I mean, okay, this tax comes online in 2018. The fiscal situation in this country by the year 2018 could be sufficiently bad that the politics of these issues are just completely different. And so if you've got a tax that's about to come online, maybe Congress can't muster a majority to prevent it from happening. So that's number one. The incremental approach, you know, one thing that strikes me about this is how much more easily this would have gone if the Democrats had done something like a big expansion of Medicare or a big expansion of Medicaid. I mean, I would have disliked that intensely, but I think they would have probably gotten some Republican support. They would have had a lot more public support than they have now.
But they would have to pay for it, right?
You know, I'm not even sure. Would that be better policy? Yes. I'm not convinced that they would have had to pay for it politically. You know, obviously, the way the politics of the stimulus worked out, debt was, increasing the deficit, increasing the debt became more problematic. But I still think that that would have been much more popular than anything that seems to threaten people's existing healthcare arrangements or something that orders people to buy health insurance or any of the sorts of cost control measures that the Democrats have talked about.
I think that is. I think it would have been politically easier. I think
and eventually
we would have
gotten them in the same place.
What's that?
And would have gotten them to about the same place in terms of universal coverage that they're getting.
Although
now.
Actually, there are people who would say that it's long term, it's worse policy in the sense that they would argue that Medicare is a worse foundation policy-wise, and I don't even know the details, than the foundation they're trying to build with this. In other words, Medicare is sufficiently flawed in terms of cost containment and various other things that you wouldn't want it to be the foundation for the whole system.
Well, I mean,
right?
there is a reason why Medicare reform is an element of this bill.
Yeah. One thing I actually like is about this tax on Cadillac plans is I think, and I would think that actually Republicans would like this, is I think that is, in principle, a pretty effective form of long-term cost control. I mean, in other words, look, I think everybody who's realistic agrees that if the government is going to get into subsidizing health care in a huge way, you have to ration in some sense. Given the number of pricey medical treatments of meager benefit, there has to be some point. The government can't just pay for everything. At some point, they just have to say, look, I realize that this very expensive MRI would tell you if you've got cancer, but your chances of having cancer are only 1 in 100,000. We can't afford to do it. And the great thing about this taxing plans, expensive plans heavily, is it encourages people to settle for more meager plans, and they just have to make their own choices about what gets left out, ideally, if the market is working well, right?
I agree that in at least in isolation, scaling back the tax exclusion for employer-provided health insurance is a good idea, even in this somewhat roundabout and leaky way that they've chosen to do it. But you know, I have the same as my view with some of the Medicare cuts. Some of them I just think are unwise, but I'm for the Medicare cuts for some of these Medicare cuts. But I don't want it, you know, but in isolation, I'm not for Medicare cuts or scaling back this tax exclusion in order to finance this huge new set of programs that I oppose.
Mm-hmm. Now, I assume that that Obama going into Thursday is ready for the Republicans to say, hey, here's what we do. And he's got these rejoinders prepared, right? And I'm guessing that they would be somewhat like this paragraph from a New York Times editorial this morning. It says, all of the Republican ideas have these basic facts in common. And I want you to tell me if this is true, Ramesh.
Okay.
They would not reduce the number of uninsured Americans substantially. They would not guarantee affordable coverage for people with pre-existing conditions. They make only feeble attempts to rein in medical costs. And their proposals to slow the rise in the cost of premiums would mostly benefit the healthy. How much of this is true?
Well, I'm not...
Do you have ideas that overcome these, that defy these stereotypes?
I am not sure which of the Republican proposals the Times is talking about. I think that some of those criticisms apply to some of the proposals, but not to others. If what we're talking about is something like, say, the Senator McCain proposal, which is to extend the tax break for employer-provided coverage to people, whether they get their insurance themselves or through their employer, and allow interstate purchases of health insurance, then I think it's not true. I think that would reduce the number of people who are uninsured by a substantial amount. It wouldn't by itself deal with the over the long run, I think it would do a lot to help the problem of people with pre-existing conditions, but it wouldn't do much in the short run. And for that, I think you are going to need to put some serious money into the state high-risk insurance pools as a transitional measure. But again, a lot of Republicans are, I don't know whether they're willing to fund it as much as it needs, but they're certainly talking about being willing to spend more on those funds.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you participated, speaking of the New York Times, in one of these room for debate things on today's Times, and we can link to your contribution about health care.
Yeah.
And I kind of read your thing quickly right before we came on the air, and I infer from it that you do not share my intuition about the politics of this, which is that, okay, well, first of all, I think it's a kind of a high-stakes gamble. I think it's a real crapshoot, this Thursday thing. I don't see how they control this in a way that A, guarantees that it works out well, and then B, there are the further political challenges in getting the votes in Congress that you outlined. But I think you don't share my intuition that if he does pull this off and they actually pass the kind of health care bill he's talking about, that it would be a momentum shifter politically, right? You don't even think it would be that big a political win if he did it.
Well, look, I mean, it makes it impossible. If this happens, some lines of attack on the Democrats, they can't get anything done, they're ineffectual, they're undisciplined, in disarray, all that stuff, I think those things aren't a big argument anymore. And you've got a liberal base of the Democratic Party that is remoralized rather than demoralized. But I think that is more than offset by the increased intensity of the opposition, and I suspect also that independents already leaning toward the Republicans would lean more so, because this isn't, you know, you've had attempts by the president to sell this plan, for example, the September speech, which at best provided a temporary lift in public opinion for it, but hasn't really changed the fundamental opposition of the public. I don't see any, you know, I totally expect this summit to be a win for the Democrats. I think Obama will outperform the Republicans. But I just don't know how meaningful it's going to be in terms of making a big shift in public opinion. And as long as that's the case, and you've got the Democrats pushing this legislation over the opposition of all the Republicans, most of the independents, and some of the Democrats, I think the public, which is going to look at this and think, you know, this is a bill they don't really like, and for the Democrats to be sort of shoving it through in that sense, I don't think it's going to make people more affectionate toward them.
Well, I mean, you can describe it as shoving it through or something. I don't see the argument that it's somehow anti-democratic to pass legislation by mustering a majority in both houses, though, which is what would have happened, you know?
I don't believe it's illegitimate in the sense that, I mean, sure, they can do it, but I can't think of a historical precedent where something this sweeping has been done over the opposition of the public with a temporary majority that everybody knows is going to shrink dramatically this coming November.
Well, I mean, first of all, it's only been, you know, relatively recent in our history where we had fine-grained polling data about every piece of legislation that passed. And in that regard, I would say that in terms of the legitimacy of this, the idea of the founders of this country was not that people in Congress were obliged to take the temperature of the public and do whatever they said. The idea was explicitly the opposite almost, which is that they elect you, you go to Washington, you do what you think is in the best interest of your constituents in the country. If they don't like it, they vote you out of office. You are not supposed to be so timidly attentive to the views of the public, especially when, as I think you'd concede, Ramesh, most people responding to these polls have no clear idea what's actually in this legislation, right?
Yes and no. Yes, and, you know, they're not going to pass a test in general. They're better informed than they are on a lot of political and policy questions, at least according to the data I've seen, just because this has been so intensely debated for such a long period of time now. I'm not going to argue with you that politicians should sort of slavishly follow the opinion polls. I don't know, though, whether the alternative here really is I think it is true that a lot of Democrats are going to support this bill because they think on balance it's a good bill. It even if they have some reservations about it, they think on balance it's a big improvement on public policy. But I think that a lot of people, it's not a question of, well, I just got to do what I think is right. I think it's we've got to get a win for the party.
Well, sure. We've
spent a year on this. We've got, you know, I mean, the sort of political considerations on the pro-passage side that we were just talking about.
Oh, there are. I don't think it's a valid argument about the legitimacy of passing the legislation that public opinion polls show opposition to it.
But I was talking about what the likely public reaction is going to be. You know, I wouldn't be in favor of people saying, you know, this is some sort of unconstitutional putsch or something. It's clearly not. But I do think that when you pass big sweeping legislation over public opposition, it is unlikely to lead to better election outcomes for your party. Now, if you think it's good enough, you think this legislation is good enough and important enough, maybe just bite that bullet and say, we're gonna vote for this, we're gonna see it enacted, and lose some more seats as a result. I mean, there's something sort of noble about that.
I'm not sure they'll lose more seats, but one question is, will there be actual doubts about the legal legitimacy of using reconciliation in that case, or is that not going to be disputed? Because there are restrictions on what you can use reconciliation for, and this is a big bill, and I assume some people will argue that some parts of it don't qualify.
Oh, yeah, there will be such arguments. There will be points of order raised, I'm sure. And I assume most of those will be swatted down by the Democratic majority, possibly by Vice President Biden in his senatorial role. If you mean legal in the sense of will this go to court, I suspect not. I think that that this is something where the Senate quite properly is the judge of its own internal rules.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
If they play fast and loose with the rules, that will add to the Republican claims of illegitimacy.
Well, it will be depicted that way regardless. I mean, the Republicans plan to depict this as fast and loose and illegitimate, I think. But that's life. So anything else you want to say about health care before we move on to a not unrelated subject, the Tea Partiers?
No, I think we can move on. Let's talk about the Tea Partiers.
Yeah, I'm curious about them, partly because I actually just wrote something for this online column I write for the New York Times. I've actually sent it in, but it's not too late to change it, so maybe if you could do a little fact-checking for me, I'd really appreciate it. I mean, one thing I'm saying, the piece is actually about this question raised about this guy who flew the airplane into the office building in Austin. Two questions being raised is, should he be labeled a terrorist, A, and B, was he a Tea Partier? And one thing I'm saying in the course of this is, I don't think the Tea Partier's ideology is as clear-cut or as clearly conservative as a lot of people think. And I mean, I do think, on balance, yes, right of center, some of them far right, but still, once you get beyond the fact that they don't like paying taxes, you have them opposing things that are both on both sides of the ideological spectrum, I think. I mean, on the one hand, yes, they oppose, you know, healthcare, liberal kind of stimulus bill, but they also oppose corporate bailouts. That's not a traditionally conservative position, right? And on foreign policy, they range from neocon to Ron Paul. On social issues, they range from libertarian to family values, right? I mean, isn't it the case that all that really unifies them is populist rage and a distaste for taxes?
Well, I think I caught all of that, although for some reason you're a little bit coming through a little bit more quietly as you kept going. Well, you know, as I think you know, National Review ran an article by Cato Byrne and and I about, or I should say, and me about the Tea Partiers, and it was based on a survey of people who said that they sympathized with the Tea Partiers and people who said that they had participated in Tea Party rallies. And there certainly is a significant diversity in this group. I mean, for one thing, among the findings was that a good third of Tea Party participants and sympathizers are people who voted for President Obama, people who think still, at least as of mid-January, that President Obama was doing a good job in office. And that, I think, contradicts every sort of image that we have of who the Tea Partiers are and what they stand for. I think it's pretty clear that what unites them is an opposition to spending increases and to debt increases. Our data suggested that, in general, Tea Partiers are a not particularly partisan but pretty conservative group of Republicans. And they tended to have socially conservative views. Didn't really ask so much about their foreign policy views, the survey that we were looking at, but they tended to actually, maybe a plurality of them, if I remember correctly, favored increases in defense spending. So they seem much more, I mean, if you were going to categorize them, I think it would be much less libertarian, for example, than just straight up conservative.
Yeah, now...
Let me add one, I think, important thing here, which is that the people who participated in the Tea Parties were really willing to take their anti-spending logic and anti-debt logic to its, I think, real conclusion, and they favored cutting Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, whereas, and that's about 6% of the likely voter population this year. But the larger group of people who said they sympathized with the Tea Partiers' goals but hadn't actually participated in the rally were dead set against those kinds of cuts. And that,
which
I think, has all kinds of political significance.
Yeah, it suggests that to the extent that this could really grow into a movement of party magnitude, you know, that its character might have to change.
Yeah, well, it means, for one thing, the active wing of it could pull the Republican Party to an unpopular position, or that they're going to be in this sort of more customarily schizophrenic position where they're, you know, for spending cuts except the big ticket spending items.
Right. So the piece you wrote about this with Cato Byrne was based on a study, I guess, commissioned by the National Review, Institute or something?
Institute, yeah, the nonprofit.
Nonprofit.
Affiliate. Yeah.
Yeah, and remind me to encourage the IRS to look into the relationship between the magazine and that institute, will you, before we...
I think you just did.
What? Did they?
No, I think you just called for it, so...
Okay, I am calling for it. I am calling for it.
You'll find it squeaky clean.
Yeah, okay. The poll, you know, they interviewed 1,000 people. A pretty small number of them had participated in Tea Party, you know, something, I don't know, 60, 80, 90 had participated in Tea Party events. much larger number said they sympathized. I'm not sure how many of those have a very clear idea of what Tea Partying is, but when I went and looked at the PDF containing that the survey findings, mm-hmm. I did not find much analysis of the small number who were Tea Party activists. Now, I realize the number is so small that you wouldn't have tremendous statistical confidence about your findings. It would still be very interesting, and I'm just wondering, did you have access to more than is online there?
Well, I think the pollster, John McLaughlin, has all that, and I think that's just available to anybody who calls him up.
Who calls him up.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, well, it's interesting that a third of those people even had been Obama supporters.
Yeah, that's right, even a third of the participants. And we're still, as of January, saying that they approved of his performance in office. Now, my guess is these are sort of just basically anti-spending, anti-debt Democrats who are unlikely to cross the aisle in this coming November or certainly 2012. But that other two-thirds of them are Republicans and right-leaning independents.
Yeah. Although if an overwhelming number of the Tea Partiers wanted to, you said, cut Medicare and Social Security?
That's right.
I'm having trouble imagining many of them having been Obama supporters. And Medicaid, I guess you said. I don't know. But that's kind of odd. But anyway, I'm very interested by the foreign policy question. You know, the New York Times had this piece you may have seen about a week ago that probably, to your mind, it was about Tea Partiers. It probably overemphasized, from your point of view, their kind of conspiracy-minded nature. I don't know if you saw it.
Yeah, I did. I did see that. I confess that I only skimmed it, it was interesting. But my interest was more in the large group of people who are sympathetic rather than sort of who's leading what protest and so forth. Which is not to say that's an uninteresting topic, just slightly different focus.
But I went to some of the websites that they identified, that article identified with Tea Partiers, and I mean, you know, the foreign policy, some of it, you know, sounded great to me because it was the part of Ron Paul that sounds good mm-hmm. to somebody on the left, you know, the critique of military intervention, and then there's, of course, the part of Ron Paul's foreign policy I don't like the critique of all multilateral involvement.
Right.
But still, I know that, on the other hand, there are right-wing hawks in the Tea Party movement. And all this is just by way of, you know, addressing the question of, can this turn into something larger and still coherent?
You know? That's interesting because... In retrospect, I do wish that survey had included some more foreign policy questions. As CPAC, which I guess was this last weekend, although it seems like it's been talked about so much, it was longer ago than that, had, you know, Ron Paul won plurality in the straw poll, and there were some pretty anti-interventionist foreign policy ideas that mm-hmm. were being showcased there. You know, one interesting thing about that, though, you know, Congressman Paul and the American Conservative Union, which sponsored CPAC, have been very skeptical about things like, and opposed outright to things like Patriot Act and warrantless wiretapping and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. From the data that we saw, that kind of skepticism is not shared by the Tea Partiers in general, who seem to be perfectly okay with the idea of ethnic profiling, for example, So to the extent that we have it, you know, it's not a great proxy for things like what's your policy towards Iran, but it certainly did not seem to be in line with the sort of Ron Paul kind of view of the world.
Okay. That's interesting. So you didn't see a big libertarian streak. You didn't, in that regard, you did not ask them about, that poll didn't ask them about kind of social values very much?
There were one or two social issue questions. There was a pro-life, pro-choice question, for example, which found that the Tea Party sympathizers, and even more so the Tea Party activists, tended to be pro-life, more pro-life than the average voter. I think just to get a sense of it, there was also a the old question about whether the government should encourage traditional values or promote tolerance was asked, and the Tea Partiers fell on the more socially conservative end of that spectrum as well.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not in that sense, I think, like the pro vote in the early 90s, which was a more secular and socially liberal vote. That's not the case this time around with this group of disgruntled populist anti-deficit voters.
Right. But do you agree that the movement hasn't settled out enough to kind of exclude systematically that wing? I mean, it's a pretty diverse mix right now.
Yeah, I think that's correct.
And so what do you think in the long run? How significant is the... I mean, I have grounds for kind of skepticism about its magnitude, but what do you think?
Well, the thing that has really struck me about it is the unease of a lot of Republican politicians with the rise of the Tea Partiers. They don't know who these people are or what they want or whether they're extreme or going to pull them in an extreme direction. And it all very much reminds me of the Republican Party sort of officialdom's reaction to the rise of the Christian right. You have a new group of activists who aren't familiar to a lot of these officials, and they just don't know what to make of them. And it seems to me that what you make of it is that you've got a newly engaged segment of your base, bringing along a couple of people who weren't part of your base, mm-hmm. who are, adding to it. And in general, that's a good thing for a party. I think that in some ways assimilating the Tea Partiers is going to be easier for Republicans than assimilating the Christian conservatives in the late 70s and early 80s was, because in the case of the Christian conservatives, a lot of them were New Dealers in economics, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And this time you just don't, at least based on the National Review Institute survey, you don't have those kinds of issue problems with the Tea Partiers. You mm-hmm. have the same problems you had with the Christian right, which is that not all these people are savvy. Some of them are extreme. But I tend to think that as people get involved in the political process, the rough edges get sanded off.
Mm-hmm. The reason I'm unconvinced as to the magnitude of the thing yet so far is that... what's been most striking about the Tea Partiers, more than the size of any one demonstration, more than the size of the total number of people, is the number of different locales in which you have seen Tea Parties, And I think that's partly accounts for the attention they've gotten. It has seemed very broad-based in that sense, but...
Do you think it's too diffuse?
What's that?
You think it's too diffuse?
Well, what I think is modern technology makes it relatively easy to take a movement that has a fairly small overall following and give it visible manifestation in a lot of localities. I would make an analogy with popular music. When I was young, a rock and roll group had the choice. It could either be regionally known, or it could make the leap to being nationally known and hugely famous. Those were the two options, right? So Bruce Springsteen, one moment, he's known only in New Jersey. He makes the leap, and then he's known he's on the cover of both news weeklies, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, these days, there are all these musicians who have really a modest following, but they can summon a concert's worth of people in a lot of places. They can get 1,000 or 2,000 people to show up in Philadelphia, in Boston, all across the country. And it's a function of technology. It's a function of the technology that makes it easy to mobilize interest groups. And so when I see something like the Tea Party movement show up in a bunch of different towns, I am convinced of the intensity of commitment on the part of the people showing up. I am not convinced that they are representative of something way, way bigger, the way I would have been convinced by the same thing 20 or 30 years ago.
Well, I think the interesting question, the test of this as a movement, I think, is not so much the 2010 elections as the 2012 elections. I think this fall we're likely to have a lopsidedly conservative electorate in which the Tea Partiers will seem to be a pretty big driver. But I think the question is going to be whether they can sustain it over time, whether they can sustain it past the victory of politicians that they're allied with, and whether their apparent strength this year is just a product of these intensity factors that we've been talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it'll be interesting. And look, I mean, I wouldn't mind seeing them become just big enough to peel away some support from the Republican Party. But of course, your thesis in the piece you wrote with Cato Byrne is that the Republican Party has little to fear in that regard, if you look closely.
Well, I mean, the thing is, if the Tea Partiers run third-party candidates in a lot of places, that would cause the Democrat to get elected and the Republican to lose. The question is, well, there's two things. First of all, that would split the Tea Partiers' natural constituency because it doesn't appear that a good chunk of people who are supporters of the Tea Party in general would not support a Tea Party third candidacy. So do the Tea Party folks really want to split their own people that way? And second, do they really want to elect Democrats who, at least based on the issues that seem to concern them most right now, are further away from them than the Republicans are? And my guess is what's going to happen is in some places, Tea Partiers will run third-party candidacies. Apparently that's going to happen in Nevada, for example, in the Senate. These will fail to get traction, that their support will diminish over time as some of the Tea Partiers decide, for example, in Nevada, that they really don't want to keep Harry Reid in office, but that in most places it's just not going to be a third party anyway, partly just because it's hard to mount third-party candidacies.
Yeah, again, easier, I think, than it used to be. I mean, the technology makes all this, anything you want to organize, a little easier than it used to be. I mean, leaving aside the legal...
The ballot access law problem.
What's that?
The ballot access law problem.
Right, right. That's true. We'll see. Any other thoughts on Tea Partiers?
Let's move on.
So we were going to talk a little about Iran. I mean, we were originally scheduled to do this several days ago, and Iran was a little hotter then because Hillary Clinton had just, had just made this comment that got a fair amount of attention that Iran's government seems to be moving toward a kind of a military, to having more and more of a military base, which is to say less and less of a democratic one. Not a lot has actually happened since then. And by the way, I don't think as a factual matter anybody really contests what she's saying. It was more interesting that she chose to say it. For years, it had been an accurate description of the situation in Iran, I think. We do have the ongoing standoff and the scenario being we're going to probably see sanctions of one sort or another, whether unilateral, multilateral, or both. And my view being that they're not going to work. And in fact, the ones being that Congress is so enthusiastic about, I think most people think will only strengthen the Revolutionary Guard. But what's your take on the situation?
Well, I think that we have a de facto bipartisan policy of acquiescing in the development of Iranian nuclear weapons while, you know, doing a lot of huffing and puffing about it. And I think that's because it's really hard to come up with practical ways of preventing that from happening. And, you know, the sanctions, even some of the strong supporters of the sanctions are not sure they're going to accomplish much of anything. And then, you know, you have people talking about regime change, which I think would in all likelihood be a great thing, but how do you bring it about? And so I think you get a lot of these sort of arguments about, well, we need to take a tougher tone, or they need to make some grand gesture toward the opposition and so forth. But at the end of the day, you don't see much in the way of concrete plans to actually do something. I don't know if you saw Richard Cohen's column today, but I mean, it just says, you know, I mean, he says, well, we just have to, the Obama administration just needs to make it clear to the Iranians that we're going to be, you know, that we could do anything. We could be just totally crazy. And it's, you know, and he says, his closing line was, it would be, at this point, it would be crazy not to do that. And it just struck me as a really frivolous way of getting to a nifty line to close your column. Because, no, we're not going to do that. We can't do that. What exactly does he want us to put on the table here that we can actually do? And then, if our bluff is called, follow up on.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a case for bluffing if you can get away with bluff. You know, as long as nobody calls your bluff, you're okay. And what a bluff is, by definition, is a gamble that that will be the case. I think the form that our bluff is actually taking, for the most part, is our not saying that we wouldn't let Israel bomb them. And in fact, some people, I think some generals, have also explicitly refused to rule out the possibility that we would do various things. So I think to some extent we're actually doing what Cohen would suggest. I don't think, I don't know that it's going to work. I'm not confident that kind of bluff will work. I'm also not sure it's a bluff. I mean, you said we had a bipartisan consensus of one sort. Don't you think we also, when push comes to shove, would have a bipartisan consensus for letting Israel bomb them? At least there aren't many people in Congress who would stand up and say that was a horrible thing, right?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that we would not stand in the way, but the question is, again, whether that actually would have the intended result of preventing the development of Iranian nukes. And I think there is, you know, the balance of evidence suggests skepticism about that.
Yeah,
you know,
well, I think
maybe
so in the long run.
Meanwhile, it would cause opinion. You know, one of the only things we've got going for us there, which is public opinion being anti-regime, moving more in its favor.
I think in the long run, it's absolutely not the solution, and I'm not in favor of it. But I also don't think, you mentioned regime change. I think, look, more democracy in Iran would be a good thing, and I think in the long run, that tends to be the way these things are headed in countries that oil states can resist the forces of history better than some others. But in the long run, nations that want to be economically modern and engage with the world, I think, tend to be drawn toward a more pluralistic system and away from an authoritarian one. At the same time, I mean, first of all, that's different from saying regime change that we could induce would be a good thing. And in neither case would I say that we should kind of lightly assume that this would be a game changer in terms of Iran's stance on the nuclear issue. Certainly, I think in terms of the insistence that they at least be allowed to enrich on their soil, if under supervision, that is never going to change. That is a strongly held view of the Iranian people. There is less support apparently among the people for a bomb per se, but I don't think we can guarantee that a democratically elected government would not want the bomb.
Would you be as worried about nuclear capabilities in a regime that was democratizing and liberalizing?
Just about, because you see, I don't personally think that Ahmadinejad is literally crazy, so I don't worry. I mean, my main worry in either case has to do with another loss in the non-proliferation game, further increasing the chances of an arms race in the Middle East, all of which just slowly increases the chances that something bad will happen or some nuclear weapon will wind up in the hands of a terrorist. So I would rather us think long-term about getting serious about non-proliferation, and I would like to see that inform some things that we put on the table with Iran, including talking a little more seriously about ultimately getting a nuclear-free Middle East, which means actually talking about the existence of nuclear weapons in Israel, although obviously not you're not going to get Israel to cash them in for some time to come. But that's not to say that you couldn't talk about steps in that direction in a way that, that wouldn't be productive here. So anyway, the answer to your question is the fact that they were democracy would not make me sleep a whole lot easier with them having nukes than it would for Ahmadinejad to have the nukes. I don't think he's going to launch a nuclear strike. And I don't think that's the nature of the threat that is posed by their possession of nuclear weapons.
Well, I guess this is where our surface agreement on dovishness falls apart, because my concern isn't non-proliferation. I mean, my main concern is that development of nuclear capacity just strengthens the power of this illiberal, destabilizing, anti-American regime. You know, causes other countries in the region to move into its orbit, that sort of thing. And if you have a change in the character of the regime, that worries me a lot less. Now, I am concerned somewhat about non-proliferation. I'm concerned about proliferation, particularly if there's a capacity of people to get a hold of some of these nukes because security isn't tight enough or what have you. But my main concern is the strengthening of this regime.
Yeah, well, I should kind of concede that I do think nukes in the possession of this regime would probably contribute more to the prospects for a regional arms race. And also, you worry more that it would embolden them in their adventures involving, say, Hezbollah, because then they would feel they would feel that then the country like Israel is less inclined to actually attack Iran in reciprocation for extremely provocative behavior, you know, exhibited by Hezbollah. So I kind of take some of that point, but I think that people who think that regime change would kind of solve the nuclear problem in the sense of ensuring that that Iran wouldn't have a nuclear weapon or in the sense that a nuclear weapon wouldn't be in any sense dangerous are wrong. And moreover, there's a point that actually I think Matt Iglesias made on Blogging Heads is that if you have a democracy in Iran that says we want to proceed with nuclear weapons, it's a more problematic situation for us in the following sense that right now, you know, if Iran says, wait a second, how come Israel and India and Pakistan can have nuclear weapons and we can't? The answer people give is, because you're a crazy dictator. Now, first of all, I would emphasize that answer doesn't have a lot of valence in Iran. You know, I mean, when you say to people, you don't understand, your country's uniquely dangerous, it's rarely the case that the people in the country actually accept that. Still, it's a kind of answer that has valence in some forums, right? Whereas
with the international community, for example.
With the international community. Yeah. Whereas if it's a democracy and they say, look, here's what we're going to do. We're just going to get out of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, at which point our legal standing is exactly the same as Israel's, Pakistan's, and India's. We're a non-member that's developing nuclear weapons. What are you going to do that is defensible in terms of international law? Well, at that point, we have a significant legal and rhetorical problem, you know. So that's again reason I think we should be thinking more about how do you solve this problem in a way that is not so kind of episodic, is not so ad hoc, right? Come up with a solution that at the same time contributes to the development of an overall non-proliferation regime that embodies universal principles that we expect all nations to abide by.
Mm-hmm. Right. And some of the same considerations lead me to think more in terms of reorienting our Iran policy towards the encouragement of liberalization and democratization and away from a focus on the nuclear issue per se, with the huge caveat that I'm not sure how you go about encouraging those things.
Moreover, I mean, short term, there is a tension between these two goals, right?
Yeah.
There's no peaceful, you're not going to induce, so far as I can tell, a voluntary agreement from this regime to solve the problem, you know, to admit much more comprehensive inspections or to let the uranium be enriched abroad, which is only a short-term fix in itself. You're not going to do that without it being good for them politically at home. Right? I mean, you are going to, it's going to have to be something that becomes a point of pride to them. Because I just don't think the sticks are going to work. I don't think the sanctions are going to kind of force them to submit. I think if a deal is to be done, it's going to be a deal that Ahmadinejad proudly brandishes and uses it to actually diminish the opposition. And so as a practical matter, I think right now there is a trade-off between democracy promotion there and solving this problem in the short term.
Yeah, that's a good point. And again, that would reinforce my inclination to move toward the democracy promotion end of that trade-off.
But what about
if I could figure out a way to do it?
But what about my claim that that doesn't solve the problem in the long run, and may, in a certain sense, undermine our current moral basis arguing?
I think that is true. But if the things that most concern me about the regime in possession of nuclear weapons is the nature of the regime rather than the nature of the weapons.
Yeah.
So.
Okay. Yeah, that is what divides us. Yeah. So you would sleep better than I would at night knowing that a democratic Iran had nuclear weapons. And again, it's not that I would worry that Iran's going to launch an attack. It's just that at the margins, it's just incrementally increases the likelihood of various things that worry me. Every new nation mm-hmm. that has nuclear weapons. But
yeah, that's a fair characterization of our disagreement.
Yeah. Okay, well then we agree on what we disagree on, and
well, that's the first step.
That's as good as it gets. So thanks for taking the time. We'll link to your various things, the piece with Cato Byrne and your contribution to today's New York Times, and so on.
Awesome. Good talking to you.
Same here, Ramesh. Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye.